What's up, everybody, and welcome to Through the Veil, episode number 44. I am your host, Alex Nelson, and it's been a little while, hasn't it? I've been grinding away at running a lot of client ceremonies and doing a lot of inner work, and the podcast has taken a bit of a hiatus and a backseat during that time, but it's finally time to get back around to it. And today's topic is going to be talking about preparing for plant medicine ceremonies, how to effectively prepare oneself to go through what can be a deeply transformative and important container in someone's life. And the special guest today is going to be me. I'm going to be talking about the thing that I do for work and how I prepare people and all of that jazz. So I hope you'll enjoy this episode. If you do, a 5-star rating helps out a ton, and sharing it with a friend are really the two most effective ways you can help support the podcast. As always, you can find me on Instagram at Alexander Diesel, and you can find me on my website, www.throughtheveil.co. Well, without any further ado, let's go ahead and jump into the topic of the day. So, our topic today is going to be talking about preparing for a plant medicine ceremony effectively. Now, there's a bunch of different things that I do with clients to prepare for a plant medicine ceremony of any type, although I will say that the majority of the work I do is with psilocybin mushrooms, and so this preparation guide is going to be a little bit geared towards that work in particular, although it will be, roughly speaking, broadly applicable to most other plant medicine ceremonies as well. And first, for those who maybe haven't met me before or haven't consumed any of the podcasts I've put out or heard much about me, a little bit of context here. I'm a plant medicine facilitator. I've been doing that work for about 8.5 years at this point. I've sat with roughly 900 people in ceremony over those years and really have tailored my approach to what I believe my core ethos is of helping support someone through healing themselves and becoming their own best teacher, because ultimately each person contains within them the wisdom to move through whatever situation they are in. My job is just to help them feel equipped with the tools, tactics, and strategies to go into the ceremony, to navigate the ceremony successfully, and to come out the other side and really interpret the things that the ceremony was trying to teach them. So my approach is very much geared towards personal empowerment and helping each person build their own tools so that as they go through the journey, they are equipped to help themselves and to work through things on a personal basis. Now, as we talk about preparing for a plant medicine ceremony, one of the strategies that I really try to employ with clients is to give them multiple different levels of intensity to which they can prepare, because everyone comes to this work and they come to it at a different level of preparedness. Some clients I get have been meditators their whole life. They have a strong journaling practice. They have continuous work with a therapist. Maybe they've sat with plant medicines before. And so perhaps they're prepared for a little bit of more intense preparation regimen. And then there are people who have never touched a psychedelic in their life. They've never really done much self-work and, you know, perhaps are coming to it from a place of crisis or a place of difficulty, who maybe too strict of a regimen is going to be disconcerting for them or make them feel like they are failing at preparing for the journey. Now, it's not that if you don't prepare with full intensity, you can't have a successful plant medicine journey, but it is important that each person acknowledges to themselves the level of intensity they are ready to bring to this process and the level of commitment that they are really going to put into their preparation, and to be realistic about that. It's, for example, if someone has never worked out before a day in their life and they come to me and say, okay, I'm going to start working out, and I'm going to work out 7 days a week, I'm going to work out twice a day, and I'm going to lift really heavy, that's probably going to be a bad idea. They're probably going to fail in some way, shape, or form. And then when they fail, they're going to feel shame around that failure. And it's actually going to set them back further than if they had approached things with a more measured, reasonable plan. So each person is only going to be able to orient for themselves of what that measured, reasonable preparation plan is as it relates to plant medicine ceremonies. But I invite you to listen to the whole podcast, choose what tools work for you, and leave the parts that don't. Now, Before I'm even preparing someone for a ceremony with specific tools in the toolkit, I find it useful to have a couple of ways of thinking about the journey itself that really, really impact the way that someone goes through the journey. And so, first and foremost, we hear this term all the time of surrender to the medicine or surrender within the journey. And surrender is kind of a funny term. It has a lot of baggage to it. And that baggage, many people will consider surrendering to mean quitting or giving up. And when we're talking about surrender in the context of a plant medicine ceremony, we certainly don't mean for a person to give up or to quit. What we mean is to surrender to the medicine in the same way that you would surrender to a teacher on the first day of class at a new school or in a new class you're taking. You go into a teacher's classroom and you are assuming that that teacher knows something you don't and that it would be beneficial for you to learn from them. And they are going to teach you in the style that they teach. You're not going to come in and dictate to that teacher, hey, here's how I need to learn. I need you to draw pictures. That's the only way I learn. The teacher is going to teach you in the way that they already teach. Now, that teaching may or may not be the most effective way for you. But when you're entering into that classroom, you're entering into this sort of unspoken contract of surrender, of like, all right, I'm willing to learn in the way that this teacher is willing to teach in this moment, in this specific class that I'm taking. And so, as such, when someone comes into a plant medicine journey, I really encourage that mindset around surrender. You're coming in, and the medicine, whatever it may be, psilocybin in many cases, is the teacher in the classroom. And that teacher is going to teach you in some sort of specific way. And we can't know for a fact exactly what that way that it is going to teach you will be ahead of time. But your job is simply to allow the teacher to teach you in whatever way it chooses to teach you in that moment. Now, of course, as someone who's seen over 900 people go through this process, it's easy for me to say, right? I can look at the process and just I know for a fact at this point that even in extreme difficulty during a journey, as someone's really going through the emotions or really processing some old wound or trauma, I have a deep trust that the medicine is working in their favor because I see it over and over again that people get what they need, not necessarily what they want in a given moment. And so it's easy for me to trust it because I've just seen repeated evidence that that is the case. But if you're brand new to this process and you've never worked with a plant medicine, perhaps it's a little bit harder to trust, and that's understandable. So I really invite to practice surrender through what I call loving curiosity. And loving curiosity is the lens through which I invite all my clients to look at their journey. So, in any given moment during the journey, as something is going on, their job is to be lovingly curious about it. So, sadness comes to the surface and they're feeling all of the sadness. One view on that would be to go, oh, sadness is bad. I need to get rid of this sadness. I need to let go of it. Another view on that would be to be lovingly curious about it. Okay, sadness is here. It's probably here for a reason. I wonder what that reason is. Hey, sadness, what are you trying to tell me? What do you want me to know? Approaching anything you experience within a journey with this loving curiosity creates some spaciousness within yourself that you are treating the journey like it is a cooperative ally instead of an adversary. And you're actually treating yourself like you are a cooperative ally instead of an adversary. It's very different than how most of us treat ourselves in our day-to-day life. We have some big emotion, let's say anger, and we're feeling pissed off about something, and then we're telling ourselves, I need to not be pissed about this. I need to let go of this, if we're even aware of it at all. And that's a very adversarial approach. It's like going into battle with yourself, telling a part of yourself it's not okay to feel this thing. And as I often say to clients, it's like if you come into the journey expecting to go to war with yourself, don't be surprised if you end up in a war with yourself because you'll find what you are looking for. If you approach yourself with a loving curiosity and an attempt to have understanding around what a specific moment in the journey is trying to tell you, it really removes a lot of the friction that people experience. Now, don't get it twisted. It can still be super difficult, super emotional, super, painful to go through those things, but there's a different psychic texture to it when you are allowing the spaciousness of curiosity in and you're allowing yourself to explore, I wonder if this is teaching me something. It's a very different mindset than sort of a victim mindset of, oh, something is happening to me. Oh, I feel out of control. I feel this anxiety is happening to me. It's like, okay, what if instead anxiety was a beautiful piece of your inner compass and it was trying to point you towards something? And if we can just understand the signal of what it is trying to point you towards or away from, the anxiety alarm bell can actually soften and can turn off, because that's the role that our emotions and our memories and our reflections play, is to try and help us navigate reality. As such, we can give ourselves the invitation to be curious about them and to be curious about the different experiences we have as a way to zoom into them in a productive way and move through them and allow those alarm bells of, you know, the more heavy, intense emotions to kind of soften and eventually turn off. Now, there's a second piece to loving curiosity, which is the loving part. And this part is often the part I say it's easier said than done. The loving of loving curiosity is an invitation to remove the judgment around whatever is coming up. So giving an example from my own life, you know, when I was younger, I was quite a bad alcoholic, as many of you will know, and was really, really struggling with alcohol. And in one of my early on mushroom journeys, I had this moment where really what I can only term as the spirit of alcoholism itself kind of presented it to me within the journey. And my initial reaction, of course, was, ah, finally, gotcha. Now I can get rid of this part of me that is not useful. And once I get rid of it, then I'll finally be better. And of course, I was treating myself like an adversary, not very useful long term. After a few minutes of that, I finally realized that that was not going to work. And that's what I'd been trying to do all the time anyways in my day-to-day life. Like every time I was trying to force myself to quit, telling myself, God, why? What's wrong with me? I just need to stop. I'm better than this. I should be better than this. Why am I such a piece of crap? That type of self-talk was me going to war with myself instead of being understanding and loving towards myself. So after a few minutes within the journey of kind of berating myself and trying to cut this part of myself out, you know, internally, I finally went, okay, what if this part, this spirit of alcoholism itself, was here for a reason? And what if that reason was actually beneficial and it was trying to protect me in some way and it was trying to love me in some way? And the moment I had that switch where I softened a little bit and I stopped treating this thing with so much judgment, it revealed to me one of the first reasons I ever drank, which was I was about 15 years old and I was going through a super difficult breakup. I had all this emotional pain and heaviness within me, and it didn't feel safe to open up to my parents, and it didn't feel safe to open up to my guy friends because I was worried about all the names I would get called. So what did I do as a young 15-year-old man with no tools in the toolkit emotionally? Well, I got good and drunk with a few of my guy friends, and once we got good and drunk, I felt safe enough to open up, have a bit of a cry, and really unburden all of this heavy emotion that I was feeling. Now, in isolation, in just that moment, alcohol really worked as a tool for processing my emotions. However, as we all know, alcohol is not a long-term solution for that. It was really a short-term solution, and the more that I leaned on that as a tool, the less useful it became as a tool. And so at that moment in time when I was 15, my ego sort of learned alcohol equals emotional connection, and I just held on to that pattern for years and years and years after it was useful. All of those insights were incredibly helpful for me because it allowed me to realize, oh man, this alcoholic part of myself is not evil. It's not some terrible, defective, broken part that I have. It's this piece of me that's trying to help me stay emotionally connected. And every time I try to force myself to quit through just white knuckling it or cold turkey quitting, my ego feels like I'm trying to quit emotional connection. And that's a core human need. So of course I'm failing. Of course I'm not able to do that. But what I was able to do after that journey and those insights was proactively create emotional connection in my life. I did that through a variety of ways, men's groups being primary amongst them. And that really helped me to lay off the alcohol as a tool because I just didn't need it as much. I had that revelation and it allowed me to really set that aside because I used a different tool for the task that was actually much more effective for the task. So you can see the way in which when something arises during a journey, if we treat it with judgment and banishment and shame and guilt, It's the equivalent of trying to go to war with it. And this is the case in your day-to-day life as well. When an emotion or a habit or behavior arises that we don't like about ourselves, our tendency is to shame it. We go, God, I'm such a piece of crap. Why do I do that thing? And the invitation is that never once has somebody created effective long-term habit change from a place of shame and guilt. Like, if that ever was the case, that you could shame and guilt yourself into having better habits, we'd all be perfect by now. Because every single one of us does it. We do something stupid. We order the pizza when we didn't want to. And then we're laying there feeling like crap afterwards. Like, I'm so stupid. What's wrong with me? Why did I order this pizza? I'm never doing this again. And yet, a week later, 2 weeks later, we've done it again. It's like, well, shame and guilt are clearly not effective tools for helping with this. And yet we continue to lean on them over and over again. So much better to try a different tool, especially within the context of a plant medicine ceremony. Much better to lead into the ceremony with this loving curiosity towards yourself. And loving curiosity is a natural way of practicing surrender without needing to force it. It's not needing to go, oh, okay, I have to surrender to this thing. I have to let it in. It's instead just going, okay, this is what is present for me. Whatever emotion it might be, whatever physical experience it might be, whatever visions I might be seeing, whatever conversation I might be having in my head, this is what is present for me. And I'm curious about why it's here. That's the reason I chose to do this experience in the first place, was so that things could arise and I could get curious about them and I could understand myself at a deeper level. Now, when someone's preparing for a plant medicine ceremony, I break things down into really three different tiers of preparation. So we've got what I call tier A, which is the essentials, like the absolute bare minimum. This is the things you absolutely should always do. And then we've got tier B, which is beneficial additives. It's a little more intricate, a little more involved, but things that are generally going to be quite helpful. And then we have tier C, which is really the maximalist approach. This is like, I'm going to do everything I possibly can to be fully prepared for a journey. So I'm going to go through these in order, and I'll talk a little bit about each of the tactics, tools, and strategies in each of the tiers in an effort to really help you prepare now that we've talked about really the big topic, which is that of surrender. So within the essentials in tier A, really the first and foremost thing is just setting and clarifying your intentions for the journey. I really think that having an intention for any type of psychedelic work is a mandatory step of the process to have a beneficial experience. Because if you don't set an intention, there is still an intention. It's just not a conscious intention. You can think of the example of someone who they go and they end up at a party and they're like, oh, I'm just going to take a bunch of mushrooms. It's like, okay, well, they didn't consciously set an intention, but the subtle behind the scenes intention was probably something along the lines of, I don't want to feel what I'm feeling right now. I want to feel something else. I want to escape my normal day-to-day reality. I want to party really hard. I want to feel like a better version of myself. I want to feel sexier or funnier or sharper. There's some story going on in the background that is their intention. And none of those are very good intentions to go into a journey with, which is why it's unsurprising that when people are unintentional, that's where there is the highest risk of things going sideways within a journey. I mean, we hear the horror stories about bad trips, air quotes there, and all of them contain one of a couple factors. You know, first and foremost, it's usually being in a super public place on too high of a dose without proper preparation and proper understanding of the substance they're taking. And usually it's, you know, a dosage that doesn't fit the circumstance and they've created no plan of escape of like, oh, if I start feeling like I really need to go have a good cry, what's my plan to get home instead of being in the middle of this music festival? So intentions applies not just to the deep plant medicine internal experience in a ceremonial setting, but also to play experiences. Now, we're not going to be talking as much about play experiences today, but it's just worth just clicking on quickly to say that you can set an intention for a play experience It's just the intention is a little bit different than an internal experience. Like a play experience, your intention might be something along the lines of, I want to deeply connect with my friends. I want to really get fully into this music. I want to dance. I want to feel, you know, the depth of the richness of the present moment while I'm hanging out with my buddies or, you know, my loved ones. Beautiful. Those can be intentions, and they can optimize those experiences to be intentional instead of being unintentional and sort of reactive and sometimes negative. Anyways, specific to a ceremony setting, when we're setting intentions, we want to be careful to not go too far above and beyond of three intentions for the journey. Because when we get above that threshold, we end up in a space where there's too many things to work on. It can just often lead itself to disappointment. So I advise clients to have between one and three intentions for a journey. And when you're in that range, it's possible that you will work on all the things that you're intending. But it's also worth noting that similar to walking into the first day of class, your teacher might not be teaching the things you're curious about. They might have a different lesson plan. Like you might walk in on that first day of class and go, hey, teacher, I've got these three questions. And the teacher is going to be like, oh, awesome. This is a really good student who cares about learning, who wants to be here and who's engaged in the process. However, they might let you know, these are great questions, but you're trying to learn calculus 4 and this is algebra 1. Like you have to learn some other stuff first. So when we're setting intentions, it's important to acknowledge that they are not expectations. They are not attachments. It's not, I have to learn these things in particular, otherwise this was a failure. Rather, it is just placing your focus on the things that you think would be most beneficial for you. Now, a process I have all my clients go through is to create a list, and for that list to be 8, 10, 12 items long of all the things they would even possibly like to work on within the ceremony, and purposely creating a long list so that when they have completed that list, they can look at the themes of all the things they've written down. This is a really common mistake I find people make when setting intentions, is they focus too much on symptoms and don't focus enough on larger scale themes or sort of directional movements of things that touch many different things in their lives. So for example, someone comes into a journey and they're like, I want to work on my alcoholism. It's like, hey, fair enough. But much better if as a starting place, we can understand a bit of where the alcoholism comes from and also the other things that trigger it in your life, because that's probably the right place to put your focus within the journey. Like if your alcoholism comes from, like myself, a feeling of emotional disconnection, and if we understood that before the journey of like, hey, every time I feel emotionally disconnected is when I end up drinking, that would give us a lot of info to ask a better question as your final intention of like, I want to understand deeply why I feel so emotionally disconnected. Because if we handle the emotional disconnection, will handle the alcoholism. So just as an example there. So I invite each client to write down 8, 10, 12 intentions. And these can be everything from big to small. You know, everything from why does my toe hurt to why do I keep engaging in this one negative behavior? Or why can't I be braver? Or why am I always sad? All the way up to like, what does it mean to be a human? And why are we here? And everything in between. And the goal is for them to just create a nice long list. And then we look at that list, you know, when I'm working with a client in a one-on-one capacity, we'll look at that list in depth and we'll identify themes. You can do this for yourself by looking at the list and seeing the themes that are there. I guarantee there will be themes. You'll look at that list and you go, 7 of these items are about self-love. And naturally then you should go, okay, well, what could my intention be in relation to self-love? And then you'll have a much better intention to come into the journey with. Now, again, just reinforcing here that you're not guaranteed to work on the things that are your intentions. Sometimes people come in with an intention that truly they are just not ready for yet because they haven't built the resilience. This happens a lot when people come in and they're like very specific about, I want to process, you know, this childhood trauma. I want to process this thing that happened to me when I was 6. And processing of old memories and traumatic moments in our life, especially depending on the intensity of them, really necessitates that we have built an equivalent level of emotional resilience to handle those big expressions of emotion that are likely to come forward in those processing moments. And so you may or may not be ready for that. And when someone is trying to push themselves to go deeper than they're ready for at a given moment, that's what can lead to difficult or bad results from a journey. And this is where, you know, as a facilitator, I spend a lot of time really getting to know the person, getting to know where their current level of emotional resilience is at, and then not pushing super hard within the journey. Like, the goal is not for us to go deeper than they're ready for. The goal is for us to go right up to their capacity and take a little bit of a step outside of their comfort zone, just a little bit further than they feel ready for, but I know that they are ready for. And then they've stretched their zone of development a little bit further out, and they're a little bit more able to go about their day-to-day life with a sense of freedom and ease and all of the things that we view as beneficial. So one thing to be careful of as people are setting intentions coming into the journey is it's okay to be really specific, but you also just have to acknowledge to yourself, like, what is your current level of emotional resilience and emotional capacity to hold really difficult things? Like, if you haven't cried for 10 years, it's unlikely that you'll be able to go back to your main most difficult thing that has ever happened to you before you actually relearn how to cry a little bit and relearn how to feel your emotions and feel safe in them. So this whole process of setting clarifying intentions is really important, but it is important as well to just go into the journey with a sense of openness as well. It's like, we have our intentions. Here are the things I would think are my best guess of what it would be useful for me to work on. And once I enter the journey, I let go of those. And the journey unfolds in the way that it needs to. One thing I often say to just understand or conceptualize the journey itself is to think about the journey like a river. And you are on a raft in the river as the journeyer. And your goal is to be going with the flow of wherever the river is going. Now, you want to be curious about your surroundings. So, you know, you're looking over at a tree on the riverbank going, wow, what a beautiful tree. I wonder what kind of tree that is. But you're not becoming attached to things, you know? So if you're 5 miles down the river, you're not still sitting there going, damn it, I need to know what kind of tree that was, otherwise my journey was ruined. And similarly, you're not attached or so attached to your intentions that you're like trying to swim upstream and fight the journey when it's trying to take you somewhere else. One more thing on this topic that's useful to know is it's called a journey for a reason. It is not just like, oh, I enter in and then immediately I have the understanding I was looking for. A lot of times the journey, the medicine needs time to kind of show its work. It's like a math problem. It has to show the different steps to get to the answer. And so there's an element of trust there as well that people can employ and can really make the journey go smoother. They're like, hey, it might show you 5 memories in a row that seem totally unrelated, totally inconsequential. But then on the 5th memory, everything clicks together. And it actually is totally related to your intention and it all becomes clear. So you have to employ a degree of trust that, like, it's a journey. You are going through multiple phases and steps of the experience to get to your understanding. And sometimes that understanding doesn't even happen within the plant medicine experience itself. It happens a week later during integration or a month later when you're reflecting on your notes. So really expanding the horizon of what you view as when you understand the journey itself and managing your expectations that things may or may not be clear directly afterwards. Sometimes they are, but often there are pieces at least that are not clear. Now, another piece of preparation that I think is really a mandatory to understand for any plant medicine journey is to understand the ego. And the ego is this often maligned, negatively viewed part of self. And I'll give a quick definition here just so that we're operating on a common basis of the term ego. So to me, the ego is the compilation of patterns, systems, and habits that each of us builds up over the course of our lives in an effort to keep ourselves safe, both physically and emotionally. And the ego really plays an important role because you can imagine if you lived 500 years ago and you were in the middle of a tribe somewhere, if you were emotionally unsafe, you know, if everyone in the tribe disliked you, that would probably actually translate to being physically unsafe. Now, it's not really the case in most places in the world nowadays. Everyone around you could hate your guts, but because we have, you know, law and structure and society, most likely it's not going to result in terrible wounds to you in most cases. But our biology isn't quite caught up to that yet. So the ego still manages physical and emotional safety with nearly equivalent priority. It's also worth noting that the ego has a real bias towards immediacy. Because some of the concern of the ego is getting you from point A to point B so that you can reproduce, so you can pass on your genes. And so the ego doesn't care as much about these sort of long-term, you know, tip of the Maslow's hierarchy pyramid of needs type of issues. It cares about, okay, do we have food today? Are we safe today? Do people like us today? Because that will increase the chance that we could reproduce. And then tomorrow is what it is, but we'll just deal with that then. And so as such, over the course of our lives, the ego builds up all of these different mechanisms and patterns that we run as a way to exist in the world. And if you're listening to this, to your ego, right now, it is perfectly successful because you are alive. You're likely under a roof, or you have some structure in which you can take shelter, and you probably have had food in the past 24-ish hours. And so as such, like, the ego views this as an absolute win. And to change anything actually seems dangerous to the ego, because whenever we change something, there's the possibility that things would fall apart and that things would be scary and would really deteriorate in a way that would be negative for us. An additional factor that comes into play when we consider the ego is a lot of the patterns that the ego exists within come from a time in your life where you didn't have a full set of options available to you. So imagine you're 10 years old and you have an extremely angry parent who's always yelling at you and is sometimes beating you. For some of you, that won't be an imagination. You'll just be like, yeah, that actually literally happened to me. And for those of you, I'm sorry, it's a difficult thing to go through. But just put yourself in that headspace for a second. Now imagine the options available to you as a 10-year-old. Well, you can't really leave, because what are you going to do? Just be a street urchin by yourself at 10? Like, that's going to be probably worse than dealing with the anger of one of your parents. And you can't really fight back because you're not big enough to fight back in most cases. So that's not really a valid option. And you can't really speak up for yourself, because that's probably likely to, you know, as I heard someone put it one time, like, it's a really irrational thing for a parent to abuse their child in many ways. It's like, how can you possibly have beef with a 10-year-old? They're 10. What did they do? And so it's like, you're dealing with someone who's irrational, and in dealing with someone who's irrational, trying to speak truth to them is not often going to really calm the situation down. It'll probably make it worse. And so what are your options as a 10-year-old? Well, what most 10-year-olds would choose is to become emotionally hypervigilant, so they can make sure that they are managing and aware of the emotions of everyone around them at all times. And their ego creates this pattern called, everyone else's emotions are more important than mine, because I need to manage their emotions to make sure I remain safe. Now, that's actually a genius strategy by the ego for the age of 10, because it's true. The option available to that kid is to be super aware and go, ooh, wow, mom's getting really angry. Ooh, maybe I can just like make the right joke, or I can be overly apologetic, or I can try to keep the peace, or I can employ some, you know, sort of manipulative strategy, using manipulative in the positive sense there, to try and cool down the temperature of the room so that I don't receive abuse. Again, genius strategy by the ego of the 10-year-old. The problem comes in 10 years later. Let's say that person is now 20. The ego is still running the pattern called emotional hypervigilance. It is constantly paying attention to everyone except themselves and going, everyone else's emotions are more important than mine. So what does that lead to? It leads to someone with no boundaries. They're a doormat. Everyone walks all over them. They can never stand up for themselves. And maybe they're not even aware of what their own preferences are. You know, this is the type of person who says, I just go with the flow. I'm cool with whatever. And it's like, no, you have preferences. It's just you've denied them for so long as a result of this pattern that you're no longer aware of them. And so we can see the way in which that person who is in dire need of being able to set boundaries and stand up for themselves, their ego created a pattern. But the ego did not create this pattern out of evil. It was not like, hey, let me fuck with Alex's life and ruin everything for him. The ego went, how can I keep Alex safe? And I can relate that in all my years of practicing the medicine work that I do, what I see over and over again is that in 100% of cases, the ego actually has a person's best interests at heart, deep down, and it has a logic to it. Like, there is a reason that you're running the patterns you are running. It's just, we don't understand the reason. and we get right down to the bottom of it, that reason is one of two things: self-protection or self-love. Understanding that gives us a lot of permission to, again, be lovingly curious about ourselves instead of go to war with ourselves. It's no longer, oh my God, I'm an idiot. Why do I have this habit? What's wrong with me? It's, okay, I want to understand why my ego built that defense mechanism. Where does that come from? Why is it there? It exists for a reason. If I can understand the reason, it can become much easier to move through it and to let go of it. And so when we do medicine work, there's this phrase, which I really detest, that gets thrown around so much, which is this idea that you're going to go in and you're going to kill the ego. You're going to get rid of the ego. You're going to dissolve the ego. And while it is certainly the case that in a plant medicine experience, a person can experience a real softening of what we'd call the default mode network or the manager portion of the mind, aka the ego, it doesn't necessarily go completely away. Sometimes it does, but often it doesn't. And then what happens after the journey? Well, almost immediately, it comes right back. And so much better if instead of trying to kill a part of yourself that is actually necessary for your survival, I mean, if a tiger bursts into your room right now, your ego is what is going to rescue you from the tiger. The ego goes, we got to get out of here. There's a tiger in the room. The higher self, you know, the Zen perfect part of yourself goes, ah, I guess it's my time to go. It's okay. And, you know, kind of goes to your deathbed in a very peaceful state, let's say. The ego says, we got to get out of here. There's a real threat to our survival. So the ego has its important place and role. And when we acknowledge that, we don't have to do battle with it. Much better to, as you come out of the journey and the ego returns, if you went into that experience having tried to understand your ego more deeply, then the two of you, you and your ego, can collaborate on creating better strategies to help you thrive in your life. Because your ego wants you to win. It really does deep down. It just thinks that if it doesn't do certain things, you won't be safe. And so it continues to run those patterns, even when they're maladaptive and they no longer serve you, because it doesn't know a different way. And additionally, because the parts of you that are wounded are beneath the surface feeling unseen. You know, if there's a part of you that was wounded when you were 10 years old and you never acknowledge the wound that you received, it doesn't matter how hard you rail against the habit that that 10-year-old built. Until you acknowledge the 10-year-old and go, hey, buddy, I see totally why you did this. I'm here for you now. We have different options available to us. Until you do that, that part is not going to feel safe because it doesn't feel like you've actually heard it out. So the invitation is, as you go into a journey, to conceptualize the ego as really a team of horses. And you can imagine that this team of horses is pulling the carriage of your mind forward in time. And you, as the conscious part of you, or the higher self, let's call it, are sitting in the carriage. And this is why people can have the experience where on a Monday, they go, I'm going to work out 5 times this week, and I'm going to eat so healthy. And then as the week goes on, it's Saturday, and they've worked out 0 times, and they have not eaten healthy. It's like, well, what happened there? Well, the ego, aka the horses, had a different plan. It had different things it was protecting against, so it pulled you off track 5 days out of 5 days in a row and put you in the ditch. Now, most of our reaction to that is to shame ourselves, guilt ourselves, get angry. This is the equivalent of trying to whip the horses into shape, and that doesn't work, obviously. You know, nobody at the end of a week of not working out and not eating right has ever been brutal enough to themselves to force themselves to build a good habit long term. The reality is, there was some reason why you didn't do the things you knew would be good for you. And we want to understand that reason. So we get out of the carriage. We take a second. We allow the horses to rest. We give them a moment of peace and say, hey, you guys don't need to run right now. I don't need you running so hard right now. I want to understand what's hurting you. And then you notice that one of the ego horses has a broken ankle, or another one has a thorn in its foot. Maybe another ego horse is frothing at the mouth because it's been running as hard as it can for 20 years to protect you, and it is tired. In this spaciousness of giving the ego a little bit of a rest, we can understand why the horses are having so much difficulty in keeping to the plan, and we can offer them some understanding, some compassion, maybe a carrot, and retrain them with a new strategy. But first, we have to acknowledge them. First, we have to understand them. And so as you go through a journey, a huge part of the preparation is just understanding that your ego is not this evil taskmaster that you have to fight against, but rather a piece of you which is really trying to keep you safe. And the more you can let that concept in, the smoother journeys go. Because a lot of the difficulty that exists during a plant medicine ceremony is this fight that people engage in against their own ego. They go, oh my God, I'm so scared. I need to get rid of my fear and I just need to be brave. And they try to force themselves by gritting their teeth to go through the journey in the perfect way. And all that results in is friction. It's them fighting against themselves. Much better to go, oh, I'm scared right now. I wonder why I'm feeling scared. As one of my clients said at one point, they were scared of losing themselves in the journey. And they're really having a difficult first 2 hours of their experience because they're just holding on for dear life, going, I don't want to lose myself. I don't want to lose myself. And upon that reflection of that's what they were scared of, which, you know, to be fair, it's understandable. Now, as an outside witness to this, I've never seen someone lose themselves in a properly prepared, carefully created ceremony container. But I understand why someone would be scared of that. It's understandable as a fear. The interesting thing is, like, why was that person scared of that and not something else? Well, the fear was related to their ego as a defense mechanism, and it was because this person saw their parents grow up in a cult and saw their parents really lose themselves. And in seeing that, what they learned was, oh, man, I'm at risk of losing myself. And so they went out and everywhere in their life, they applied that to everything they were interacting with. They applied that to relationships. They applied that to work. They applied that to friendships. Every time they thought something was taking their possibility of being fully themselves, they'd push it away because they're terrified of losing themselves. All of that insight, which was the point of that journey that day for that person, all of that came through getting curious about the fear. Not through shoving the fear aside. Like, the fear was the teacher. And so as someone goes through a journey to really embrace the thought of surrender or embrace the thought of loving curiosity is to treat all parts of yourself, every emotion, every feeling as valid and important, and to be curious about them in a way that allows you the spaciousness to investigate them. So we talked about understanding the ego. We talked about setting and clarifying intentions. Next, we'll talk about what is called a dieta or a diete. So this is a way of eating, but it's more than that. It is also a way of consuming information in the lead up to your journey that optimizes for what I like to say is you having a clean internal petri dish so that the things you grow within the journey as your little science project, air quotes, are the things which you're trying to grow and they're not a bunch of other bullcrap. Now, in terms of the specifics of the dieta, how that looks for each person is going to be very different, and there's different traditions that hold different standards of strictness to the dieta. What I invite my clients to do is to eat clean, whatever that means for them, because each person has a pretty good intuition of what it would mean to eat healthy, and for them to engage in that behavior for a minimum of 3 days prior to the ceremony, ideally a week, and if they really wanted to be strict about it, they could do it for 2 weeks. No longer than that, no months-long preparation process. That's putting a lot of pressure on yourself to be perfect instead of acknowledging where you're at and going, okay, I want to eat clean in the lead-up to this journey, whatever that means for me. So if you're going from eating McDonald's every day, you probably shouldn't tell yourself, okay, I'm going to eat just salad every day. Like, it's probably not going to be effective. But maybe you switch over to just home-cooked meals is what healthy is for you that week leading into the journey. Each person comes to it at their own level, just acknowledging to yourself, okay, here's the level I'm at, and then doing your best to eat clean. This does a couple of things. First and foremost, you'll just feel better when you're eating clean. And so that better feeling and coming into the journey with that sense of clear-headedness and emotional capacity and probably physical capacity as well really optimizes for you to have the level of energy that is useful within the journey itself to get the insights you're looking for. It's like if you come in and you've got a 10 out of 10 in energy, that is a lot of resources you can apply to learning things within the journey and processing things and moving through different lessons. Whereas if you come in as a 1 out of 10, you know, you're feeling totally like crap all the time because you eat McDonald's every single day. Well, it doesn't mean you can't have a successful journey. It just means you have less resources to attribute to the journey itself. And so it's not surprising when you go a little bit less deep, or maybe you feel a little more nauseous than the next person. Another huge part of following a dieta in the, you know, days and weeks prior to a journey is just, it helps you to rule out that the thing that you come up with when you're in the journey is just that you need to eat better. Like, it's really disappointing for someone when they're like, okay, I want to go in, I want to work on my anxiety. And the big revelation in the journey is like, yeah, well, you eat like crap all the time. Of course you're anxious. It's like, that is probably something they already know. And nonetheless, it's an important lesson to learn. But if they were to eat healthy in the week or two prior to the journey, chances are that would not be the insight that comes up, because they would already be feeling better and less anxious because they're eating healthier. So the invitation is to eat clean, whatever that means for you. Doesn't have to be too strict. Doesn't need to be ridiculous, over the top. You know, there's some ayahuasca dietas out there that are extremely regimented and extremely strict. Sometimes those can do more harm than good in some cases, because what they create is an internal system of failure. If someone is not able to stick to it, they feel like, oh, I wasn't able to hold to it, and now I'm not good enough, so the ceremony is going to go bad. That's not the goal. When I'm sitting with someone, I want them to come into the journey feeling like they've done the best they were capable of at the place that they're currently at in their life. And that involves having different levels that they can attribute themselves to, and different levels that they can apply themselves to of intensity. If they go too intense past their level, that's just going to lead to them feeling stretched thin, feeling like they're barely making it, or feeling like they're failing. Now, the second part of a dieta is probably equally important, and that's this acknowledgement that within you, you have not just a physical diet of food, but an information diet of the things you are consuming from an information standpoint. So this applies to social media, for sure, news, 100%, movies you watch, podcasts you listen to, even books you read and friends you spend time around. You can imagine if you're preparing for a journey and in the week before the journey, you watched every horror movie known to mankind and you only hung out with your most negative, pessimistic friends, would it be at all surprising if your journey ended up being really scary and difficult and maybe pretty pessimistic? No, because you're essentially polluting your mind with a bunch of bullshit that's not even your own problems. It's like other people's problems and other scary content. And then you're going into the journey expecting that not to take a toll on you. And so as someone is leading into a journey, really the invitation is certainly in the 3 days prior to a journey, ideally in the week prior to a journey, and again for 2 weeks, if you really want to be a superstar and you feel like you're capable of it, get off of social media as much as is possible. Stop watching cable news, certainly, because it's almost entirely tilted towards negativity and things going wrong. Give yourself a little bit of a break from hanging out with the friend that you know is super negative, and maybe just try to consume some positive things. You know, watch some nature documentaries, watch some things that are beautiful to you and inspiring and make you feel expansive and good and like you're capable and positive. This is just optimizing, again, your mental landscape. Just like we're doing with the physical landscape with food, we're optimizing your mental landscape so that you have the emotional resources when you go into the journey and you're not dealing with a bunch of what we call OPP, other people's problems. Other people's problems are a hell of a thing. And yes, there's a lot going on in the world at any given moment. And yes, it's all important. But for you to get the healing you are looking for from your journey, if you spend your entire journey thinking about other people's problems, I can guarantee that that is not going to benefit them or you. So give yourself the permission to take a little bit of foot off the gas on the negativity you consume. Give yourself a little spaciousness from it and come into the journey with a refreshed mind that will allow you to really process things in a healthy, positive way as you go through it. So the last thing we'll talk about when it comes to the tier A, or just the basics of preparing for a plant medicine ceremony, is going to be microdosing. Now, microdosing is a really important feature of the preparation process for a lot of people. It is not mandatory necessarily, but I really advise it for a couple of reasons, and we'll go into those here. First and foremost, it allows you to vet the potency of your medicine. Now, I will be putting a link in the show notes of a couple of really good testing kits that are out there that can help you test the potency of specifically mushrooms, but also a variety of substances. Super, super useful. It's a product called Q-Test that I have no affiliation with whatsoever, but it allows you to see how potent the mushrooms you have actually are. Super useful. However, even using a tool like that, what we want to know before we get into the ceremony is, how sensitive are you to the medicine? This helps with how you're going to dose. If you are super duper sensitive to medicine, we don't want to give you a hero's dose when that's going to put you so far in the journey that you don't even remember anything and you don't come back with the info you're looking for. Not that that's especially common, but we want to know your level of sensitivity to the specific batch of mushrooms in this case that you are going to journey with. And so engaging with a microdosing process helps you do that. If you're doing true microdoses, we're talking 100 milligrams, 150 milligrams, 200 milligrams of powderized mushrooms. And for more tools on microdosing, like look at my microdosing guide, which will also be in the show notes. That goes into all the particulars. But if we test with those types of levels a couple of times on the lead-in to the journey, you're going to either feel it or not feel it. And this gives us a lot of information in terms of orienting you for the journey of how strong the mushrooms you got are and how sensitive you are to them. So you want to run a couple of microdosing experiments in the lead up, starting low, so starting with 100 milligrams, and then working your way up to maybe a maximum of 200 or 250 milligrams on the top end, and just kind of noting what you experience at each step of the way. You know, even if you take the 100 and you feel it, it's like, cool, you're pretty sensitive to the medicine and the medicine's pretty strong. So that's awesome. That gives us a lot of navigational info coming into the journey rather than just flying blind and not having any idea of how sensitive you are to the medicine. Important notes on microdosing. You know, the first day you're doing it, if you are an absolute beginner to this and you've never microdosed a day in your life, it should be a day you're not super busy. And I want to, again, be clear, 100 milligrams, not grams. That would be an extraordinary dose, milligrams. And the best way to do this is really to powderize the mushrooms in, let's say, a coffee grinder, or to get a product that is already pre-powderized. And in doing so, you have a pre-dosed sort of supplement to use. And then to consume it that way, that helps make sure that the dose is equal across the batch rather than, you know, different parts of the mushroom have different amounts of psilocin, the active component. And in doing this, there's a secondary benefit. As you're microdosing, you're going to start to build some positive rapport with the medicine in your lead up to the journey. You know, there's a lot of things people get anxious about as it relates to plant medicine journeys. There's ones that aren't even, you know, super logical, but they still get anxious about them. Things like, oh, what if I'm allergic to the medicine? Or what if it really disagrees with me? Or what if I just feel worse than ever? Or just there's all these types of anxieties that people can have on the lead up. When you're microdosing, you're getting a little bit of exposure to the medicine at a low level, and you're answering a lot of those questions beforehand, before we get to the big journey day. So even just taking 100 milligrams, it's like, look, that's a low enough dose that if in a mythical universe there was a person who was super allergic to psilocybin, which I don't know if that exists, but maybe there's a lot of biological variability out there in the world. I've certainly never heard of it. That person is taking such a low dose that it would be unlikely to stimulate a true, you know, difficult health risk for them. And so they would get a sense of like, oh, hey, man, my tongue felt all swollen when I took that microdose. Okay, I might actually be allergic. Not that that's going to happen, but that would give them a sense of that. And so doing the microdosing prior to the journey helps build some rapport with the medicine. Additionally, I really like to think of microdosing as a magnifying glass for your internal landscape. So you can think of a journey dose or a ceremonial dose, which, you know, typically we're talking 3 grams, 4 grams, or 5 grams, somewhere in that range. A ceremonial dose is like a microscope, and a microdose is like a magnifying glass. So it's allowing you to zoom in a little bit, to become a little bit more aware of your internal landscape. And in that gaining of a little bit of awareness, you're actually probably going to build some positive momentum coming into the journey, which is going to benefit you in exactly the ways we were talking about before. It's the opposite of having a bunch of scary movies you watch before a journey. It's like you're starting to build some positive rapport with the medicine coming into the journey. So microdosing, super, super useful tool and something I rate as relatively essential, because we want to know, like, does the medicine you have work before you get to the day of a ceremony, especially if you're hiring someone like myself and you're paying a lot of money for that. Like, we want to make sure that what you have works before you get to the day of the journey, rather than rolling the dice and going, oh, we don't know how much you should take. We don't know how it's going to work. We'll just have to figure that out on the day of the journey. And then additionally, it has the benefit that you build some positive momentum and you build some rapport with the medicine before you get to the day of the experience. Now, the last thing I like to talk about as sort of a mandatory part of my preparation process is just understanding the journey itself and understanding the ways in which medicine tends to speak to people. So every journey is different, is the reality of it. There are no two journeys which are ever going to be exactly alike. However, there are some common themes and ways in which journeys tend to speak to people. When you understand these ahead of time, it helps you to actually navigate the journey in real time. I call it like learning to speak the medicine language. Like, imagine you're going to France and you're going to go to Paris, and Paris is beautiful. And even if you don't speak any French, I'm confident you could have an amazing experience of Paris. However, if you spoke French, I guarantee your experience of Paris would be even better. It's no different here. It's like, if you understand some of the ways in which a journey can speak to you, you're going to optimize for your ability to have a conversation with the medicine rather than you having to decipher everything after the fact. So I'm going to talk a little bit first about just the four different main types of journeys, as I deem them, four different categories of experience you can have. And then from there, I'll talk a little bit about just the specifics of how a journey can speak to you. So laying out these four categories, you can have all four of these, you could have just two or three of them, but these are really the different ways in which medicine tends to speak to people. Of course, it's possible someone could have an experience outside of these four, but this really covers a lot. So I'll list them quickly and then I'll go in depth on each one. We have visual experiences, we have emotional experiences, number three, we have physical experiences. And number four, we have what I call like an internal conversation or internal question and answer session. Now, again, a person can have all four of these, so they could just have two or three, or they could just have one. But the reason I talk about them prior to a journey is when it comes to psychedelics, people are very focused on the visual aspect of a journey. And don't get me wrong, most people experience some form of visuals, but not everyone does. And the visuals aren't always even the most important thing going on. Like, a lot of times the visuals are important in conjunction with an emotion being felt, or a conversation you're having with yourself in your head, or something you're feeling physically. Often those are the keys that actually unlock what the visuals are trying to communicate. And so in going into a journey, a visual journey, you may see things. And I like to be clear with my clients that in a journey, the majority of profound visions happen either with the eyes closed or with an eye mask on. You can think about it this way. When you're going into a journey and the mushrooms or the other substances are acting as a microscope, what are we pointing the microscope at? If we're pointing it at the external environment, so let's say there's a beautiful tree outside, wow, that might become the most beautiful tree I've ever seen in my life. It's amplifying my awareness of the thing that's external. But most people's objective when they're coming to a journey is to amplify the internal experience, amplify their internal awareness. And so closing the eyes or throwing an eye mask on is a really good way to do that. It really causes you to focus inwards. And, you know, the kind of half joking, half not thing I say to people is like, you're unlikely to talk to your dead grandpa and have a vision of him speaking to you with your eyes open and looking out at the room. But if you're going inward, that's totally an experience people have sometimes, and it's a possibility. So going inward is really where the profound visions are. And additionally, it's worth noting that a lot of visions, not all of them, but a lot of them are archetypal, metaphorical, or symbolic during a journey. So if you were to see, let's say, a cackling skull during a journey, now there's some people out there who are going to go, oh, that's terrifying. What if that's something evil and maybe it's trying to possess me? I've never seen that be the case. I like to be clear about that. But What if instead of having that fear relationship towards it, you went, oh man, interesting, cackling skull. What does that represent? And maybe just before seeing this vision, you were thinking about Trudy from work, who you don't like very much. And then you see this vision of a cackling skull. It's like, oh, it's a symbol of how I feel this person's energy is, or how I feel the relationship between me and this person is. So it's a symbolic representation of an energy. And when you treat it as such, it allows you a lot of ability to navigate through the different visions you have. Now, some visions are literal. You know, you can have a literal experience of processing some sort of memory. You can have a literal experience of, you know, seeing yourself have a conversation with a friend, let's say, or a passed on loved one or a present day loved one. But a lot of the visions that happen during a journey are this sort of metaphorical or symbolic thing. So that's just good to know, because it allows you to not need to focus on taking everything literally. Like if you're seeing whatever, the laughing skull, that doesn't mean, oh my gosh, this is bad. It's like, oh, what is that representing? Back to that tool of loving curiosity from earlier. Now, visual is often accompanied by emotional journeys. And emotional journeys are pretty much just what they sound like. It's some big emotion coming to the surface, and your job is to be curious about it. So imagine you're in the journey, and all of a sudden you just start feeling super angry. Now, again, you've got two options at that point. Either you can deny the anger and go, it's not okay to be angry. I need to get rid of this anger. Or you can take what I advise to be the better solution and better path forward and get curious about the anger. And we'll touch on this tool a little bit later in more depth, but there's a psychotherapy modality called internal family systems, which is very useful here. And it really employs this methodology of really speaking to the parts of yourself directly. And so this is what I invite all my clients to do when they're in a journey. It's like, if anger is there, don't talk about it in the third person. Go, anger, what are you trying to tell me? Anger, what do you want me to know? Where am I feeling this anger in my body? And kind of that direct approach is going to allow the spaciousness for that emotion to speak back to you. Now, a key thing when it comes to emotions is, if an emotion is one that you have repressed from yourself for a long time, so we'll use that anger example there. Maybe when you were young, you saw a lot of anger in the household and you told yourself it's never okay to be angry. Anger is bad. And in doing that, you created this space where you denied yourself from what is a very important emotion. Like, anger is the emotion of boundaries. Anger is the emotion of standing up for yourself. Anger is the emotion of when someone crosses something that they shouldn't have crossed or something is unfair. Anger is the activating emotion. It's very different from the externalized anger of like rage, let's say. They're totally separate and don't need to be conflated. But, you know, anger has an important role in place. But maybe you didn't see that growing up. You only ever saw the unhealthy expressed anger and it was really hurtful. So you denied anger from yourself. And then here you are in a journey and anger is coming up. Well, what may happen is you try to have a conversation with the anger and all it does back is just, ah, you know, it's yelling internally. And that could be a difficult experience because you're like, well, I'm trying to have a conversation with the anger, but it's not saying anything to me. And I like for my clients to imagine that, imagine you have a friend who has been trying to give you advice for 15 years. And every time they try to give you advice, you tell them to shut up and go away. And imagine anger is that friend who's been trying to give you advice for 15 years. And every time anger tries to give you some advice, back to the point earlier about, you know, it being the internal compass, it's trying to point you in some direction, it's trying to warn you about something, you tell it to shut up and go away. Is it really so crazy to you that that friend who you've been telling to shut up for 20 years might not be super excited to talk with you right away? When suddenly you're like, hey, I'm here. I want to hear what you have to say. I'm ready for your advice. And so it also requires a little bit of patience. You know, speaking to your emotions and being present with them requires permission. Like, the deepest level of surrender, and trust me, easier said than done. I get it. But the deepest level of surrender a person can experience during a journey is not needing to change something and being totally present with it. So if anger is there, you're just like, okay, anger is here. I'm going to be a little curious about it, but I don't need to change it. It's okay for me to feel angry. I don't need to rush myself out of the experience of anger because there's nothing wrong with feeling anger. It's permittable and it's okay to feel. in giving yourself that full level of surrender and presence with the emotion, that is what allows the emotion to feel safe enough to blossom open and start to give you some responses, start to give you some answers, and you can start to understand where it comes from. So again, you can experience any emotion. Could be happiness, could be joy as well. You have to give yourself permission for those too. I know if you're anything like me and you're sitting there in a plant medicine journey, you're kind of, if you're not suffering, you're like, man, I must not be learning fast enough. I'm not doing it right. And that's not the case. Like, you can have a beautiful, joyful, playful, funny, giggly journey, and that can be just as productive and impactful as a difficult, emotional, heavy, really doing the work journey. Both are just impactful. So giving yourself permission for the emotions in any direction and getting curious about them. Third type of journey is a physical journey. Now, this is perhaps the most unexpected of the four and can be the most disconcerting for people, I think, because they don't know that mushrooms and other plant medicines can have this physical component to them. And so it causes worry when they're suddenly in the journey and they're having a physical experience. Now, one of the things I like to highlight here specifically when it comes to psilocybin and why it's such a preferred medicine for me as like the main tool I like to use is the profound physical safety of the substance. Now, again, this is not medical advice. So each person has their own tolerances and their own individual biological makeup. But speaking on averages here, mushrooms are one of the safest substances we know of. Like, we don't know how much you'd have to take to die, but it's definitely a lot. It's definitely like above, I think they ran a study where they gave rats the equivalent of 80 pounds worth of mushrooms. And it was only at that point where they started to see negative health side effects come in. Certainly you'd have an impossible time trying to eat 80 pounds of mushrooms, so unlikely to happen. Because mushrooms are so profoundly physically safe, when you are within a journey and you are having some sort of physical experience, you can rest assured that it is psychosomatic, meaning your brain or your mind or your emotions are causing your body to feel something and process something through the body. Now, a lot of the indigenous traditions have this idea that there's a lot of different ways for us to purge or to clear out energy. And for a long time, this was sort of treated as woo-woo, you know, like, oh, that's whatever. Yeah, that's crazy. Oh, you're purging energy by throwing up, or you're purging energy by, you know, sweating or shivering or shaking or crying. But what we've come to find in modern day psychology and some of the studies being run, specifically when you look at Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score, for those that haven't read it, it's an amazing read. What we find is that trauma and emotion can actually be stuck in the fascia of our muscles and can actually get trapped in the body at the point where there's an initial trauma or an initial difficult moment. What does this tell us? Well, it tells us that in the trapping of these emotions or traumas within the body, they also need to be processed physically. It can't necessarily just be processed through talking about it. And so sometimes that processing comes through a variety of different manners during a journey. I'll give an example here of, you know, I've gone through some really difficult moments of sexual trauma in my life. And I was in an ayahuasca ceremony once, and I had really processed a lot of thinking through the sexual trauma mentally, but I had never processed it in my body. And in this ayahuasca ceremony, I had this profound experience of like my hips specifically. I just felt this urge to just shake my hips back and forth and shake my legs back and forth. And it was literally felt the trauma from that region of my body leaving my body. And it was really beautiful and freeing. And I felt so much lighter afterwards. And the friend even commented like, Alex, you seem like you're walking different. Like, there's a difference in my gait as I was moving through the world as a result of releasing this trapped emotion and trapped trauma. Now, your experience may or may not be that intense and clear cut, but there's a bunch of different things that can come up physically. First and foremost, you know, just feeling tension somewhere in the body, like, oh, my right leg feels super tight or super tense, or why does my arm feel so tense, or I feel butterflies in the stomach, or I feel pressure on my head, you know, kind of a funny one that a lot of overthinkers will get, will be like feeling pressure in the head or feeling a little bit of a headache coming on. Like, literally they're pressurizing their head through thinking so much. There's so many thoughts trapped in there. They feel head pressure. Regardless of where the physical experience comes from, Your job is just to be curious about it and be curious about what this is trying to tell you in a given moment. Now, in my own journeys, I had one where I felt my left knee started to hurt. And, you know, I was already like an hour and a half deep into this journey and nothing else was going on. So I was a little bit frustrated. So I had myself a little pity party at first where I was just like, oh, great. Now my knee's hurting. Fantastic. Once I was done with my pity party and not feeling sorry for myself anymore, I went, okay, knee, what do you need me to know? What are you trying to tell me? And the moment I asked that question, all of a sudden it unfolded this entire memory for me of when I was like 11 years old and I was trying to jump from this cliff down to this lower cliff. And when I landed on the lower cliff, I twisted my left knee, the knee that was hurting during the journey, and almost fell off of what would have been roughly a 200-foot drop off and would have certainly died. Very traumatic moment as an 11-year-old and not something I'd ever really processed, not something I'd ever gone in depth and really moved through and understood. All of that processing that happened, which was really beneficial, came through the literal physical sensation of kind of a dull ache in my left knee and with me being curious about it. So as you're going through your journey, there's a multitude of different physical things you can experience. You might feel the urge to shake, like I expressed. You might feel just a dull ache or a tension in some specific part of the body. But the invitation is just to be curious about that as well. Treat that like that is an important teacher, because I can almost guarantee you that it is. The last piece on that is, as you feel the urge to shake, sometimes you'll know exactly what you're clearing out and sometimes you won't. And I say urge to shake because it's not like it forces you to shake your body. You just feel like, oh, I think it would feel really good right now to like shake my body a little bit. And so I encourage you to go with that urge, and you can be curious about it, but you may or may not get to know exactly why or what you are clearing in that given moment. So that's physical side of things. The fourth category is what I call the internal question and answer session, or the internal conversation. So this type of journey is pretty much just what it sounds like. It's you having a dialogue with yourself in your head. And it's not quite like a voice comes out of nowhere and tells you the answers to the universe, but it's sort of like you ask yourself a question like, oh, why do I have anxiety? And you just suddenly know an answer. You're like, well, when I was 12, my mom left me at home for 2 days and I didn't know if she was ever coming back. And so ever since then, I've been really anxiously attached because I think people are going to leave me and not come back. It's like, that sounds like it actually is the answer. And so these types of journeys are a little bit more rare with that level of clarity and direct conversation. But when they do happen, they're wonderful because they're pretty easy to navigate. You just like ask questions, get answers. And so I tell people about that one because if you're ever finding yourself laying there in a journey waiting for something to happen, start to ask yourself some questions and kind of pay attention to what comes up. Like listen to yourself and see what pops up as you ask yourself some questions. So these are the four different types of journeys. Again, you can have all four of these or just one or two of them. But the point is that you don't become overly myopically focused on just the visual side of things, but focus on the whole picture of all the different things that can happen during an experience. And understand that a lot of things which happen during a journey are symbolic or archetypal and not literal. That's going to help you a lot with your integration and also with communicating with the journey in a given moment. If you see a beautiful tree during a journey and under that tree you feel so safe and loved, okay, maybe that tree is like a family tree. Vice versa, maybe you're a person who had a bad relationship with your family, and so you see a tree during your journey and under it feels unsafe and it feels dangerous. It's like, oh, okay, well, maybe that's your family tree. Oh, okay, so it's representing something. It's not literal. It's not a literal tree. It's a family tree. Additionally, the context each person has, and we'll talk about this in the dream interpretation section of this, but the context a person has can be totally different for the same symbol. So if person A grew up terrified of dogs and person B grew up loving dogs, if a dog shows up internally in their vision state, in their journey, it means a totally different thing. Like for person A, it's like, oh my God, I hate dogs. Like dogs are a representation of fear and, you know, danger. And for person B, a dog might be a sense of like friendship or loyalty or some representation thereof. And so the different symbols will mean different things for different people based upon the context. And part of what a good facilitator helps you do is to parse through all of these symbols and understand some of what they're trying to tell you in a given moment. So This just about wraps up the tier A of what I call the essentials in preparing for a journey. Now, we'll talk here about some of the tier B, what I call beneficial additives to preparing for a plant medicine ceremony. These are the things that are like, if you do these, your journey will almost certainly go even better. And most of them are fairly simple to do and don't require a lot of complication from you in terms of practicing them. So I'll lay all three of them out here, and then I'll touch a little bit in depth on each one to give you a deeper picture of what the actual practices can look like. And they're pretty obvious. You'll probably have heard of these. We have meditation, we have journaling, and we have breath work. So why these three? Well, all three of them, meditation, journaling, and breath work, are practices of really getting present with yourself and being in the present moment. And why is this useful for a plant medicine journey? Well, one of the main difficulties I see some people have when they're getting into a plant medicine experience is perhaps never in their life have they sat with themselves and really sat with their own potentially uncomfortable emotions and uncomfortable feelings. And so the first time ever that they're really sitting with their discomfort is in the journey. And that can feel kind of overwhelming. It can feel difficult. All of these things, meditation, journaling, and breathwork, allow you an arena in which to practice sitting with yourself, sitting with your own potentially uncomfortable emotions. And in doing so, it's kind of like the training wheels for the bike of the psychedelic journey. So we'll talk first about meditation, because I think that is the most easily accessible for most people. Journaling is potentially more impactful, but it is also something that people seem to like to do less. So I like to touch on meditation first. When we are doing meditation in preparation for a plant medicine journey, it does not need to be so complicated. This is the main mistake I see people making, is they go, okay, so I need to meditate for 30 minutes to an hour every day, and I have to achieve a sense of zen and peaceful, total bliss, clear mind. It's like, that is not the objective. That is an objective that comes after months and months and months of consistent practice. That is not our goal here. Our goal, simply stated, when it comes to meditation leading into a plant medicine journey, is for you to spend time sitting with yourself and sitting with your whatever is coming up in a given moment. And so what does that look like? Well, sit down, set yourself a very short timer. I would invite 5 or 10 minutes maximum if you are just starting out with meditation. And the objective is just to sit there with no distractions and be present with yourself. And pay attention to, you know, really consider this mindfulness type of technique. Pay attention to what is present for you. Are you feeling agitated? You know, likely for your first 5 meditation sessions, the internal dialogue will be something like, this is stupid. This is so boring. I wish I was doing something else. When am I done? Why hasn't the timer gone off yet? And just pay attention to that. And you can use your breath to bring a little bit of calmness to you. You don't need to focus too much on the breath, but just a simple count of in for a count of 4, out for a count of 4, nice and slow and steady, can be a good way to kind of focus the mind a little bit. And your objective is just to be present with whatever is there internally. The more you practice this, the more clear it'll be what is there. You may go, oh man, I'm feeling really sad right now. What's up with that? And just practicing those same tools we talked about, as within the journey of getting curious, like, okay, why am I feeling sad? Where's that sadness coming from? Or maybe trying to get more specific, like, okay, I'm feeling sad, but actually I'm feeling abandoned. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, well, that's very different than sad. I wonder why I'm feeling abandoned right now. Who do I feel like is abandoning me? And sort of this reflective, curious approach to what your current experience is allows you some space to practice sitting with whatever is there for you. Which at its core, one of the main things any plant medicine ceremony does is it gives you an arena in which to spend an extended amount of time sitting with whatever is present with you and doing it without distractions, relatively speaking. So not making the meditation super complicated, because we don't need you to be a perfect meditator who is able to clear their mind. We just want to give you some at-bats, some practice rounds against yourself, air quotes against, in just getting some space to feel what you're feeling, to notice what your body is experiencing. And in doing the two of those things, you're kind of building your skill set to be able to do that at an even higher level when you're within the journey. Again, psychedelics are going to act as that microscope when used at high doses. So your ability to do this will be turned way up during a journey. So don't get discouraged if you find this really hard or if you don't feel like you're getting any clarity on your emotions. The point is just to sit with whatever is there and just be with it. It's additionally really beneficial because you're giving yourself this level of permission and self-love. Because just in the act of sitting and feeling what you're feeling, what you are telling yourself is, it is okay to feel what I'm feeling, and I deserve space and time to feel it, which is an act of self-love. Like, you imagine if you're talking to a friend and they said, I'm feeling really sad right now. And you were just like, all right, well, see you later. I got to get out of here. They would probably go, oh, okay, I guess it's not okay for me to feel sad. But rather, if they're like, I'm feeling really sad right now, and you just sat in front of them and said, okay, tell me more. Why are you feeling sad? What's going on for you? They would probably feel like, oh, my sadness is actually important and it's worth talking about, and I deserve space for this. This person values me and loves me. Well, you can do the same thing for yourself. It's pretty straightforward. Like, when we feel an emotion and we run away from it by using coping mechanisms, all we're doing is telling ourselves, it's not okay to feel this. It's not acceptable for me to experience this. But when we turn towards ourselves and we create intentional arenas in which to feel, we're employing an act of self-love. We're going, it is important for me to feel this, and I deserve the space to feel it. It's like being a friend to yourself. So meditation, super, super simple. Make it as easy as possible. Remove the friction. You don't have to have the perfect song. You don't have to have the perfect spot. You don't have to have the perfect time. It doesn't need to be long. Just if you can do 5 minutes a day for 2 weeks leading into the journey, that will be beneficial. That's plenty. If you do 10 minutes a day, even better. Awesome. But scale to your current level of skill as it relates to meditation and be realistic with yourself. As we talked about earlier, like, these are not mandatory pieces to get something out of a journey, but they are beneficial additives. They are things that will assist you when you get into the journey. So next we have journaling. And journaling, similar to meditation, has the benefit of you creating space to be present with what you're feeling. And journaling has an additional benefit that meditation doesn't have, which is when you put things down on paper about how you are feeling, it creates a sort of externalized objective experience instead of an internalized subjective experience. And by this, I mean, when you write something down, you'll look at it down on paper. And, you know, during that day, it may feel super scary or triggering or heavy, but you might look at that same journal entry the next day and be like, gosh, why was I so worked up about that? That thing was actually not a big deal at all. Oh, that was actually totally fine. It worked out really well. So it creates this kind of like external objective set point of what you're feeling in a given moment or on a given day. And then when you reflect on it later, it allows you a lot of spaciousness to go, man, oh, that thing I was super anxious about is just like not true and didn't come to pass at all. Or maybe even, oh, the thing I was anxious about totally happened. And actually it was fine. It wasn't a big deal. It was actually totally okay. And so journaling creates this spaciousness where you can put something down on paper. Writing helps you organize your thoughts, which is additionally useful because when a thought is bouncing around in our head, it has this like weird momentum to it where we don't really think about it logically necessarily. Like if you spill a glass of water, internally, your dialogue might be, oh, I'm such a fucking idiot. Why am I so damn clumsy? What's wrong with me? Why do I always do this? Oh my gosh. And just kind of like ricochets around in the cage of the psyche. But if you put that down on paper, I guarantee you'd be like, whoa, I'm being super harsh on myself. Holy crap. It's just a cup of water. It's okay. It's not a big deal. And you'd be able to reflect a little bit more objectively. So when you put something external, it also allows you to organize the thoughts and be more objective about looking at them. So what's the practice? Well, again, I encourage you to make it super simple, to not get complicated, but rather just do it in a way that you will be consistent with. So maybe at the end of each day, you spend 5 minutes writing down just the most important highlights of your day. And just like meditation, maybe the first 10 journal entries you do are just like, this is stupid. Why am I writing? My day was fine. I didn't experience much. But eventually what's going to start to happen is you'll start to put down some detail. You'll start to put down some things that happened, some things you felt, the highlight of your day, maybe the difficult part of your day. In doing so, you're going to start to gain more and more emotional clarity. You'll become more and more clear on what you're feeling and potentially even why you're feeling it. One of the beneficial additives of journaling above and beyond everything I've just described is that you start to be able to identify themes and patterns. If you have a month worth of journal entries, you'll look back and go, man, every Wednesday at 2 p.m., I get really pissed off. What's up with that? And you wouldn't see that theme on just an individual given day. But when you see that it happens every Wednesday, like, man, that's weird. That is really consistent. Why do I do that? And then you'll reflect and go, oh, well, I have a meeting with Terry every Wednesday at 2 p.m. And it's no wonder I feel super activated and I feel super, you know, angry after that, because that's not a person I love that much. So just giving yourself that externalized set point creates a little bit of ability to notice patterns that you would otherwise miss. It's almost like having a little therapist, a little mini therapist, to notice things for you that are external. So journaling, super, super important, super useful. Again, make it simple. If you prefer journaling on your computer, journal on your computer. I encourage you to remove distractions. So just open like a blank notepad, rather than having like three apps open in the side. And, you know, journaling on your phone is generally not as effective because it's just so distracting. I personally think that pen and paper is the best because it forces you to slow your thinking down. But just do the thing that you're going to do. Like, the most important thing is that you do it at all, not that you get it perfect based upon Alex's, you know, personal preferences of what works well and what doesn't work. So giving yourself space to journal, ideally each day, but set yourself a goal that's realistic. You know, if it's five times a week for 5 minutes each day, that's awesome. That's going to be better than nothing. The last tool we'll talk about here in tier B of things that are, you know, beneficial in preparation for your plant medicine journey is going to be breath work. So breath work is an interesting one because breath work is a tool for regulating your nervous system primarily. Of course, we can still have insights and breakthroughs when we do really deep breath work sessions, but that's not really the type of breath work I'm talking about here in this context of preparing for a medicine ceremony. When you're doing breath work in preparation for a medicine ceremony, what you are doing is building a skill that helps you emotionally and regulate your nervous system. So you can think of your nervous system as this entire system you have that is either activated or in a state of calm. Now, I'm really simplifying things here for the purposes of just making this really easy to understand and really easy to use as a tool. There's a lot of nuance here, but I'm giving you the basic points because it's the most useful way to think about this in relation to a journey. And so everything we experience in our day-to-day life, we experience from either a place of calm or from a place of activation or agitation on a nervous system level. And we can have experiences of the exact same things that can have totally different emotional outcomes based upon whether we are activated or calm. So a person cuts me off in traffic. If I'm in a very calm nervous system state, it's just like, oh, okay. I mean, maybe they're in a hurry and that's a little frustrating, but whatever. It's fine. No big deal. If I'm in an activated nervous system state, well, we all know how that looks. It's the anger. It's the road rage. It's the, oh my gosh, why would they do this to me type of thinking. And that sort of doesn't serve anyone because A, you're suddenly not thinking clearly about the situation. And B, it's not even that you are more able to feel the emotion. You're feeling it from a place of activation that really obfuscates the picture. It doesn't give you clarity on why something is triggering you. And so it's a dichotomy that's worth acknowledging that the goal within a plant medicine ceremony and just generally in your life is like, can I give myself permission to feel my emotions and permission to feel fully without judgment? And at the same time, if I can do that from a place of nervous system calm to the best of my ability in that given moment, that's going to give me actually a lot more emotional capacity to work through the thing. Because if I'm engaging with one of my emotions from a calm nervous system, it actually creates space for that emotion to be its own experience and for me not to become overly attached to it. So I'll give an example here. Imagine you're feeling some anxiety. Now, when people feel anxiety, it can be really overwhelming, you know, even leading to things like panic attacks. And feeling the anxiety sometimes feels like, oh my gosh, I am so anxious right now. Like I'm made up entirely of anxiety right now. And that's a symptom of nervous system activation because if you were in a calm nervous system state, your experience of anxiety go, oh man, there's a part of me that's really anxious about this thing. Or, gosh, I'm feeling anxious about that upcoming event. That's okay. And you sort of have this space between you and the emotion. Now, the degree of space you have is going to be based on the degree of nervous system calmness you have. The calmer the nervous system, the more developed that practice, the more space you'll have between you and the emotion. And you'll be almost able to observe it from external and go, oh, that's interesting. I'm feeling really activated about that. That's, I wonder why that is. And get curious about it. So that's useful for just obvious reasons. Like if you are in a plant medicine experience and you are having some old memory come up and you're feeling super activated about it because your nervous system's all out of whack, you can still have positive healing come from that experience. But much better if you're in a calm nervous system state and this part of you that's experiencing the activation of the memory has something to ground itself with. It's like, can I be the stable, deeply rooted oak tree so that the parts of myself that experience trauma can really know that it's safe now in the present day? They can have something to grab onto that'll help them feel grounded and rooted as well. So breath work is really the easiest and fastest way to practice this because on a physiological level, it literally regulates the nervous system. I mean, you think about any person ever that has had anxiety or having a panic attack, how are they breathing? Oh my gosh, I'm freaking out right now. It's not good. Oh my gosh, what's going to happen? And even just like speaking like that and breathing like that, I can feel my nervous system rising a little bit. I feel my shoulders getting a little more tense and I feel myself kind of speaking a little faster and things are a little bit more serious. And oh my gosh, and much different when I slow down my breath. I give myself space to take nice long inhales through the nose. Nice long exhales through the mouth and create some space for my nervous system to come to a place of calm, of regulation. And then even something which is really serious that I'm dealing with becomes much easier to deal with. And obviously you can hear the difference in the tone of my voice between the two states of being. If I'm in a calm, regulated nervous system place, well, guess what? My whole system goes calmer and interacts with that thing and generally what's going to be a more positively oriented way. If my whole nervous system is super activated, well then guess what? I'm going to interact with everything from a place of more activation. It's going to seem more serious. It's going to seem like everything's falling apart and things aren't okay, etc., etc. So we want to practice this prior to getting into the medicine journey because old patterns die hard. Like if every time up to this point, every time you've ever felt agitated in your entire life, you start to breathe faster and you start a high activation nervous system pattern of breathing, it will be totally unsurprising to me that within your journey, you fall right into that same pattern. So practicing skills of just slow breathing, taking intentional 5 minutes to literally breathe as slow as you are able to. Okay, how long of an inhale can I take? And there's a little trick here taught to me by Andrew Huberman via his podcast, which is what we call the two in-breath, one out-breath. So you take a nice long inhale through the nose as deep as you can, nice and slow. And then when you're all the way at the top of the breath, draw in a little bit of an extra breath. So it's like, and then right at the top here, a little extra sip of breath. And you can do this through the mouth or the nose. Both are fine, but I prefer the nose because it has some additional benefits. And then you're going to let that breath out with a nice, long, slow sigh. If you do this a couple times, your nervous system will immediately begin to regulate itself and will come into a calm, non-activated state. And so just practice doing this. And you want to practice in two ways. Practice with a specific time of day. You know, typically you could start your meditation practice with this little practice of breath work, do it for 5 minutes, and then do classic meditation for 5 minutes, and then do your journaling afterwards. Like there's a great little 15-minute morning routine that allows you to get into your body, regulate the nervous system, have some space for your emotions, and then capture some of the insights. The secondary arena in which you want to practice this breath work is any time throughout your day where you feel really activated. And it's like, it's so funny because we learn about this stuff in grade school, right? Like it's almost a cliche because of that. It's like, take a couple of deep breaths. You're feeling very angry right now. You need to take a second. But there is actual science to back this up that quite literally, if you do this practice of long, slow inhale through the nose, little extra sip of air at the top, and then sighing slow out breath, your nervous system will come to a more centered, more grounded state. It'll be more regulated and you'll be able to be less activated in relation to whatever you're dealing with in that given moment. So give yourself that space and practice in real time. If you find yourself super activated by something, go, okay, here's a beautiful practice arena. I feel triggered by my family. Cool. What a beautiful practice arena for me to see if I can regulate my nervous system just a little bit in this moment. And in doing this practice, both the consistent practice and also the reactive practice, you're building your skill set for when you're in an actual plant medicine ceremony. Because as we spoke about, really heavy stuff, difficult stuff can come up during a journey. And if you can create a little bit of groundedness and rootedness for yourself, you're going to be doing yourself a huge service in giving yourself a little more space to process those things coming up from a place of safety and, as we spoke about earlier, like emotional resilience, versus if you're immediately super activated, obviously it's just not going to flow as smoothly from that place. So breath work, super, super useful practice. Just in general, it can be a great way to regulate your emotional state. But specific to plant medicine journeys, practicing this sort of slow double inhale and then slow exhale through the sigh is a way to create some internal groundedness, some internal space that's going to give you some really, really profound benefits coming into a plant medicine journey. So this basically covers all of tier B for beneficial additives or things that I highly recommend you practice at least a little bit coming into a ceremony. Again, these are not mandatory for a fully successful ceremony. I have had plenty of clients come in, no meditation practice, no journaling practice, no breathwork practice, and still have beautiful, profound, impactful ceremonies. It's just, if you practice these things prior to your journey, I can nearly guarantee you're going to go a little bit deeper. Your ability to navigate is going to be a little bit better. Your ability to understand the things the journey is telling you is going to be a little bit better. Your emotional resilience is going to be a little bit higher. All of these things will contribute to an even deeper, more profound experience than maybe you otherwise would have had. So highly recommend these, but not mandatory. So this brings us to tier C, or the absolute maximalist approach. Now, this is some of the stuff that I find really fun and I practice in my personal life just because I think it's super duper useful. But by no means are these mandatory pieces to have a successful journey. These are for the person who is already practicing meditation, they're already practicing journaling, they're already practicing breath work, and they already have maybe sat in a plant medicine journey before, or just, you know, they've been seeing a therapist for a number of years and they've really built a lot of tools already for themselves. So in the maximal approach, we have two main tools that I find extremely useful as they relate to plant medicine journeys, and that is dream interpretation, dream journaling and dream interpretation, and what the psychotherapy modality called internal family systems that we spoke a little bit about earlier. I'll talk about both of these in depth and give you some practices for each, but again, I can't highlight enough, like, you do not need to be perfect at these. Even if you just do them a little bit, they'll have benefit. So dream interpretation, we'll start there. Why is dream interpretation useful for psychedelic journeys? Well, there's a really interesting study done by the Imperial College of London where they measured people's brainwave states while they were on the plant medicine ayahuasca. And what they found was that the brainwave state when people were on ayahuasca was the same brainwave state as people who are dreaming, with the only exception being that the wakefulness brainwave, the brainwave that signals that someone is, you know, awake and consciously aware, obviously in ayahuasca, it is activated, signaling that they're awake and aware, and within dreams it is not activated typically unless someone is lucid dreaming. And so it's this really interesting crossover of this idea that the brainwave state between at least ayahuasca, but I would conjecture that all plant medicines from experience, the brainwave state is the same brainwave state, relatively speaking, as the brainwave state when you're dreaming. This is because both are dreams and plant medicine seem to speak what I would consider to be the same language. And that language I would call the language of images and symbols and feelings and emotions and, you know, physical experiences. And why is this the case? Well, this is where I'm going to step firmly into the realm of guesswork and of theory, but I would guess that it is the case because you think about when you're young, you think about when you're a baby. The way that consciousness proceeds is through a specific kind of set of different things that you learn and you experience. So first, the first thing that comes online as a baby isn't even what we would necessarily call emotion. It's more like feeling, like feel hungry, feel wet diaper, not pleasant, feel uncomfortable, feel unsafe. These are things that like a very small child, like a 0 to 3 month old child is experiencing. They're just experiencing feelings. You couldn't even really call them emotions at that point. And there's some really interesting studies about how even at that age, like you're not really seeing the world through your eyes. You're just feeling the world through feelings. And then we have emotions come online. So then it's like sad because mom's not near. And the emotions aren't very complex at first. They're quite simplistic, but that builds over time. But note that a child of that age does not have words yet. They don't have words to describe their experience. So they don't think in terms of, I feel sad right now, what's going on? They just have the experience of sadness, or they have the experience of anger, or they have the experience of whatever emotion is present for them. And then as they start to get older, they start to see the world, and the world starts to represent itself in images to them, and those images have associations to emotions. And so really, when we think about the way that consciousness actually builds in the individual, it's first feelings, and then emotions and images are kind of the next things to come online. And it's not until whatever age that the person actually starts speaking that words are even a part of the picture. And so both dreams and plant medicine speak to us in this more basic, you can consider, but it's also a more comprehensive language of feelings, emotions, and images. Now, of course, you can have a conversation in a lot of plant medicine journeys, but it's not always the case. And so dreams, the thing that you have every night, and yes, if you are the person who's like, I never dream, everybody dreams every single night that they get sufficient sleep. It is a fact. So you do dream. It's just you don't remember your dreams. And we'll talk about some specifics of how to remember them in a second. But every night you have a miniature psychedelic experience that's going on in your bedroom as you're sleeping. And we just do nothing with those. We just kind of go, oh, that's weird. I had a crazy dream last night. And maybe we tell someone, and maybe they're kind of bored by our story. And then so we don't really tell that many more people anymore. But dreams are super interesting. They contain tons of insight about your life and about things that your subconscious and your unconscious are trying to communicate to you. And they could be profound teachers in their own right. Now, they have their limitations. You know, dreams are not always going to be focused on these big macro themes that someone is trying to learn. Sometimes they're going to be focused on just immediate things that happened that day. But nonetheless, they're instructive and useful to reflect on, if we give them the space and time to be instructive and useful. And similar to psychedelic journeys, as we spoke about earlier, they speak to us in the language of symbols, emotions, you know, visions. And you'll notice that oftentimes in a dream, you're not really having a conversation with someone. It's almost like you're mind reading, like rare dream where you're watching someone's mouth move and they're saying words to you. Much more common that you're just kind of looking at someone and you're having the experience of thinking, oh yeah, they're feeling angry at me and I feel scared, so I have to run away from them. And so dream interpretation, why is it useful? Well, it is a purpose-built practice arena for you to practice the skill of interpreting symbols and interpreting your own internal messages before you even get to a psychedelic journey. And what this is going to do is two things. A, it's going to improve your ability to, after the psychedelic journey, interpret your journey, because you're going to have this huge skill set built of practicing interpreting your own mini journeys every night. But B, it's going to actually improve your ability to navigate the psychedelic journey in real time. And doing this is super helpful, because when you start to speak the language of symbols and start to be able to interpret them in real time, back to the example earlier, like you see a tree and it feels like so safe and loving under it. And it's, oh, it's my family tree. Like if you understood that during the journey, your ability to navigate forward and get deeper into the journey is greatly enhanced, because instead of just going, wow, that was weird, there was a tree during my journey, and then after the fact, you're like, oh, maybe that was my family tree. That all happens in real time while you're in the experience. Now, again, this is a language that you have to learn. It is not natural to most of us, because most of us speak and think in words. And so it's actually practicing speaking the language of symbols, of emotions, of feelings, of images. And in practicing that, you're building up a skill set that'll help you actually steer the ship within the psychedelic experience to some extent. Now, you're never going to be steering it completely. You're not going to be telling the journey where to go, but your ability to interpret allows the journey to show you more. Oh, wow, that tree is my family tree. And then the journey shows you another vision of you with your family under that tree and how safe you felt, but you were five. And it's like, whoa, okay, well, now I know specifically the time it's telling me about, but maybe I wouldn't have gotten that insight if I didn't have this toolkit. So how do we practice interpreting our dreams if it's so beneficial? Well, first and foremost is remembering them. And a lot of people will say they don't remember their dreams, as we spoke about. There's two things you can do that are quite simple before bedtime to increase the chance that you will remember your dreams. The first is, it seems so simple that it's stupid, but it actually really works quite well, is state out loud to yourself, I'm going to remember my dreams tonight. And what this does is it turns your brain, especially you say this right before bed, like right before you're going to sleep, it turns your brain into that being a priority that I remember my dreams tonight. And your brain is going to prioritize that instead of not prioritizing it, which may be the state you're currently in. The second piece, which is, you know, hard to hear for some people, but it's true. Weed or marijuana really significantly reduces the dreams people have. And this is not just on a mental level, but also on like a actual physical level. It reduces the quality of sleep you get, even though it feels like, oh, I sleep so good after I smoke. There's been quite a few studies at this point demonstrating that people actually sleep less good in terms of quality of sleep after smoking. And so removing that and removing alcohol and removing any other crutch that someone is using to get to sleep. Now, if you're an insomniac, I get it. I've worked with plenty of clients who are. It's its own difficult thing. Maybe the dream interpretation isn't the tool for you up front. Maybe that's a tool to use later down the road. But everyone else, remove those crutches and give yourself some space to actually have a full experience of sleep. And you'll be surprised at how much can come up when you stop smoking, you don't drink before bed, you don't take certainly Ambien or any hypnotic substance, which can knock you out over the course of the evening, and you create some space for your dreams to pop up. Now, you can actually supplement with mugwort, and I encourage people to use their own judgment here and to use their own dosing schedule and be, you know, clear about their own sensitivities and whatnot, because mugwort can make some really intense, vivid dreams, which can be beautiful if you're trying to remember your dreams. I also find that if I'm using like a mugwort tea before bed, I'm probably not going to sleep quite as well because the dreams are going to be so vivid and so intense that it's like almost not that restful going through them. For whatever reason that is. And that may be particular to me, but just, you know, a word of caution. But it can be a great tool for getting your dreams. Now, the second part is what happens when you wake up. So you want to have directly on hand, whether it's your journal or a voice recorder, or even just the voice recorder app on your phone on a shortcut, you want some way to capture the dream immediately. Because what we've all experienced at some point, at least, is you wake up and the dream is super clear. And then like 5 minutes later, you're like, what the hell was that dream about? I can't remember for the life of me. If you get the dream down right away, you'll be surprised at the amount of detail that is still present for you. But as your brain starts to shift away from the dream state and starts to shift into normal day-to-day waking consciousness, you start to lose sort of the memory stamp of the dream on your brain. And it starts to slip away unless you've recorded it. So you want to try to record it immediately. The second invitation is just to record it in such a way where you're not trying to be perfect about remembering the whole damn dream. Just start writing. Don't, oh, I need to start from the beginning perfectly. If you just start putting stuff down on paper, the rest of it will spill out onto the paper most of the time. And just giving yourself permission that it won't be perfect. Same lesson you have to learn for psychedelic journeys is like, they're not going to be a perfect capturing. You're not going to get this perfect representation of what the journey meant to you exactly down on paper and exactly the way you want it, but you'll get most of it. And that'll be enough for you to look at and interpret later. An additional tool here, using a voice recorder, can be quite good because you can remain laying down with your eyes closed and you can put your voice into the voice recorder without having to really change the state that you're in. So that can be really useful if you're able to do that. Obviously, if you're sleeping next to a loved one, they may not be super into that. But, you know, if you're sleeping on your own or if your loved one's super chill with dream interpretation, maybe they're fine with it. But that can be a really great solution. You just do want to make sure that you transcribe it later on and actually put it down written somewhere, typed out, because you want to be able to actually look at the dream, you know, on paper, relatively speaking. So once you've captured your dream and you have it down somewhere, then the interpretation happens. And the invitation is, the interpretation, especially while you're first practicing it, don't take it too seriously. You should treat the entirety of your dream interpretation as a sort of exploration or curiosity or a, I wonder if this is what this meant, or a theory, rather than a, oh, this is what this was telling me. Because look, you're going to get things wrong at first. And so if you had a dream about you and your partner, and you see the two of you in caskets next to each other, and you have this clear sense that your relationship needs to end. I mean, maybe your relationship needs to end, but also maybe it's just telling you that, like, the current form of your relationship isn't working and you have to have some hard conversations with you two. Or maybe it's just telling you that you're scared of your relationship ending. Or maybe it's telling you a million other things that are specific to the visions of the dream. And if you trust yourself too much at first that you know exactly what the dream means, it's just going to lead to you having some difficulty, because dreams are super not literal most of the time, and it takes time to practice that. But give yourself the space to interpret the dream. My article about dream interpretation and me actually going through interpreting one of my own dreams will be in the show notes. So if you want, you can read through that. That gives you some specifics on interpreting dreams beyond what I'll give here. But suffice to say, just go through your dream and ask yourself over and over again, what do I think that meant? What do I think that meant? What do I think that meant? And pay special attention to if you have multiple instances of similar symbols or similar ideas coming up in multiple dreams over the course of a week or 2 weeks, then those add credence to the fact that there might be a theme, or that, you know, a specific thing is what your subconscious is trying to tell you. So dream interpretation, huge benefit as it relates to psychedelic journeys. It is literally you learning to speak the language that psychedelics seem to speak to us. And in doing so, you're able to have a conversation with the medicine instead of just receiving the visions and then having to interpret them later. All right, so last but not least, we're going to talk about the psychotherapy modality known as internal family systems. Now, internal family systems is a fairly simple to understand modality of therapy that has really been taking off recently, past couple of years. And of all the therapy styles I have encountered, I believe this to be the most beneficial and useful as a standalone practice, but also in relation to plant medicine journeys. So I'm going to give you the absolute basics here. I don't profess to be that a therapist of internal family systems, but I am pretty well versed in how it works. I've read a multitude of books about it, as well as practiced it with many clients over the years, and can give you at least the basics, which can be useful to you as it relates to plant medicine journey. So internal family systems at a high level is this idea that within you, you contain all of these different parts of yourself. And these parts are objectively observable in the fact that, you know, as you go throughout a day to day, if you've ever had that experience where, like, you tip over the glass of water and then a piece of you jumps in and says, God, I'm such an idiot. And it's like, where did that come from? That was just, it's a glass of water. It's okay. But there's some piece of me that jumped in and said a huge judgment. Or the fact that oftentimes we go through our day and we do things that are objectively counterproductive to what we are trying to accomplish. You know, you're trying to stay sober and then you have a beer. Whoa, why did that happen? I understand all the reasons I shouldn't be drinking. I understand all the reasons that I don't want to drink, and yet I ended up drinking anyways. Like, well, a part of you reached forward and took over the system for a moment. Internal family systems has a way of thinking about each of these parts, which I think is useful to know. We have what are called protectors. And so protectors are protecting other parts of yourself. We have what are called exiles, or the parts of yourself that are wounded at various different points in time, different traumas happen to you, or even just difficult moments, parts that are wounded. And this is what protectors are protecting, is the exiles. And then we have what we call the true self, or the higher self. This is the part of you that's, you know, the idealized version of you. It's the part of you that feels expansive and positive and loving. Now, protectors is broken down into two categories. We have what are called managers, and we have what are called firefighters. And true to their names, managers are the long-term strategists. So you can imagine, I'll play out a scenario here. If you were someone who dealt with a lot of anger growing up and really got yelled at by your parents all the time, and they're pretty verbally abusive to you and told you you're a piece of crap. Well, all of a sudden, now in present day, you're at work and Steve over in marketing is really a dick to you. And he always tells you your work isn't good enough and you're a piece of crap. And why, how do you even work here? Now, it's a pretty extreme example. It's unlikely to be true, but who knows? Maybe you're experiencing that. And in that, the manager approach to managing that circumstance would be to create some strategy that allows you to avoid the pain entirely. So maybe you ask your boss for a transfer to a different division, or you simply just don't return Steve's emails, or you put a filter on your email inbox so you don't even see his emails, or, you know, any number of strategies. You don't walk by the water cooler that's near his desk so you don't have to see him. These are manager strategies. They're sort of long-term strategies created to help you mitigate the chance of even encountering the trigger, because talking to Steve feels a lot like how mom and dad used to talk to me, and that feels very triggering and unsafe to present-day me. Firefighters are the behaviors you engage with when a trigger has already happened. They're the way that you manage your emotional state when you already feel like something unsafe or something that triggers an old wound has come up. So you accidentally run into Steve in the parking lot and he just gives you an absolute earful, and then you go home and you drink 12 beers, or you go home and you order 3 pizzas, or you go hook up with a random person. The goal of it is to get you out of feeling the way the exile feels and get you into feeling some other stable emotional state. Now, the interesting thing about protectors is they don't have to be positive behaviors. The goal is just to get you out of what you're feeling and get you into a different feeling that the protector deems as more safe, possibly just because it's more familiar. And a lot of times we see this in the destructive behaviors that people employ on a day-to-day basis, where it's like, hey, you know that eating 2 pizzas every night is really bad for your health. However, to the protector, it's worth the trade-off. It's like, I'm willing to feel total crap in my physical body, because at least feeling like total crap in my physical body doesn't leave me sitting here terrified about my life and terrified about if I'm living up to my purpose. It's like, it's a trade-off. It's a choice that the protector makes, that it would be better to feel this sort of low-level malaise or this, you know, physical discomfort generated by eating really crappy food, because then we don't have to feel this other thing. Now, managers and firefighters, of course, can have a lot of crossover. You can have a manager that's drinking, or you could have a firefighter that's drinking. So manager drinking would look like, oh, you just drink every night, even if you're feeling fine, even if you're not feeling triggered, you just drink because you know it's a way to achieve a consistent emotional state that to you feels desirable, rather than the possibility that you'd feel triggered, or as we described, you know, something happens, you feel very triggered, and then you lean on drinking as a firefighter. Now, what's important to understand about internal family systems as it relates to psychedelic journeys is the way that parts work happens is really turned up to 11 during a journey. So you're presented with different parts of yourself during a journey very frequently, and your ability to interact with them and communicate with them is turned way up. And so this is really useful, because sometimes in an internal family systems therapy, it takes a while to get the parts to feel safe, or for you to buy into the therapy modality, or for you to create the space to have conversations with your parts and to actually open up to them and start to understand what they're trying to protect you from. But within a journey, that can happen quite naturally. And we see this a lot, both with MDMA therapy, but also psilocybin therapy, that people will use these words to describe them. They'll go, yeah, you know, I was going through the journey and there's a part of me that was so scared, but then there's this other part of me that was so brave. And so I went inward and I did this and I did that. And then, you know, part of me was worried, what if this doesn't work? But then a part of me was like, I'm sure it's going to. And people naturally describe their experience with this language of parts. Like they say, a part of me this, a part of me that. And it's really interesting, because that is the way that we speak to ourselves within internal family systems, is using the language of parts. And that sort of important thing of getting the process of talking to your parts is really, you know, heightened during a journey. And so what we can do ahead of time is practice talking to your parts so that you have the skill set already built, and maybe you've even already become familiar with and built some rapport with some of the parts of yourself, so that when you get into the journey, you kind of know where to navigate to, or you know that if these certain parts come up, you can navigate them effectively. Now, again, what I'm going to give you are some really basic techniques. And one of the things about internal family systems is it's better with an external therapist asking you the questions, but it is something that you can do on your own. And so if you want to read further about this, the book No Bad Parts by Richard Schwartz is a great book. He's the creator of Internal Family Systems. It's a very approachable, easy to read book, and can be a great way to get your feet wet with this. But I'll give you some basic tools here. So first, from an understanding standpoint, like we talked about with the ego earlier, protectors are not evil. They're not bad. They're just trying to keep you safe. They're just tools and strategies of emotional management that were developed at some point in your life in which they served you in some way. And so we can remove the shame and the guilt around them as best we can and stop trying to judge them for the behavior that they are undertaking, and rather understand like they're doing that behavior to try to keep us safe, or try to keep a part of us safe. You know, you imagine there's little 11-year-old Alex terrified inside my mind, and he's scared in a corner, and there's this big protector called drinking, or this big protector called worrying about everyone's emotions except his own, and that protector is trying to keep little scared 11-year-old Alex safe, because 11-year-old Alex does not know that we have different tools in our toolkit now, and that we can do different things in present day that maybe weren't available to us when we were 11. And so understanding this, again, we remove some of the shame and the guilt when it comes to the protectors. It's like your protectors, whatever they may be, as negative as they may feel, exist for a reason. That reason is to try and keep a part of you safe. And so when we are navigating protectors, what we don't want to do is try and shove past the protector and get immediately to the younger part of us. Rather, what we want to do is get the understanding of what the protector is protecting, and ideally get the permission of the protector as we go into ourselves, that it leads us, this is what's called a trailhead, it leads us to the exiled part of self, to the scared 11-year-old who is terrified that, you know, people don't like him, or whatever the case may be. And so how do we do this? Well, it involves, of course, all the tools we've talked about before: meditation, journaling, breath work, creating a calm internal nervous system state, and it involves speaking with yourself, quite literally. I advise you to talk with your emotions directly. Okay, what am I feeling right now? What parts are present? Well, there's a part of me that feels super agitated right now, and it feels a little bit angry because of something that went on earlier today. Okay, so part of me that's feeling agitated, what do you want me to know? What are you trying to tell me right now? Oh, well, I just want you to know it's not fair, first of all, that person said that. And it's also not fair that, you know, this always happens to us. Okay, I hear you. I'm with you. So what specifically about it is unfair? Like, what are we feeling is the injustice here? Well, it's not fair that other people don't consider us. Okay. So why are we so worried about always being considered? Well, don't you remember when we were 10 and everyone was bullying us and didn't consider us at all, and we were just on our own? How painful was that? We don't want that to happen again. Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, that would be really, really scary. I can understand why I'm trying to keep that part of myself safe that got bullied when he was 10. Like, I wouldn't want that to happen again. You know, part of me that's feeling a little agitated and is feeling some injustice, like, what other tools are available to us right now? Well, I guess we could, you know, speak up for ourselves. Or I guess we could, like, not associate with that person if they're, like, really negative for us. We don't have to be around people like we did when we were 10. Oh, okay, cool. Well, do you mind if I speak for a second to the 10-year-old part of myself? And so on and so forth. And the idea is we want to use the protector as the beginning of the trail through which we walk forward towards the exiled part of ourselves. And it's actually very instructive, because instead of wandering around in the dark, hoping, okay, I hope I meet these wounded parts of myself, you can literally just look at your patterns and look at the emotions that are present for you in a given moment, especially in a moment where you feel really activated or feel really agitated, and just carefully, gently, lovingly ask questions until you get to deeper and deeper layers of understanding with yourself. Now, one thing I will say is that this could be really difficult emotional work. Like, there have been many internal family system sessions where I'm just sitting here having a conversation myself and I'll burst out crying. I'll have a bunch of anger come up. I'll have a bunch of anxiety come up. It can be deeply emotional work. So engage in this at your own, I don't want to say risk, but at your own judgment and own discernment of what you feel ready for in a given moment. The nice thing is, when you're doing it sober, you can always just stop. You can go, okay, that's enough for today. Thank you, parts, for being here. I appreciate you showing up for me. But if you're feeling brave, this can be a really good way to start to explore what parts are present for you before you even get into a journey and start to become acquainted with them. Because again, this is all about internal relationships. To jump back to that example from earlier, like imagine that you go and suddenly show up at the door of your friend who's been trying to give you advice for 15 years. That friend does not trust you yet. Even though that friend wants to look out for you, they're like, this motherfucker has just been ignoring me for 20 years and they do not care about my opinion at all. They feel disrespected even. They feel like they've been trying to keep you safe, but you haven't been trying to keep you safe. And so it would take time to build that relationship and for that person to trust you. And you can lay that groundwork. You can show up and go, hey, I understand I haven't always been listening to you, but I'm here now and I'm listening. So I'm here to, you can tell me whatever it is you feel ready to tell me, and I'm here to listen. I'm happy to hear it. And as that relationship evolves and trust is rebuilt, those parts tell you more and more and more, and they're more and more willing to let you go visit the exiles, which many people would term as the inner child, the parts of you that are wounded at various different points in time that have become sort of frozen in time in, you know, a traumatized or a painful pattern. Now, it's also the case that sometimes we have patterns that exist and reinforce themselves over time. And so a good example of this would be if someone gets bullied from grade 5 to grade 8, but the bullying is never that severe. It's just like a little bit of bullying. And it's never something someone would go like, oh yeah, I was traumatized. There's that time that bully beat the crap out of me. They just go like, yeah, you know, kids are always like a little dismissive of me. You know, they included me, but they always just kind of dismissed my ideas. And so there can be this secondary quality of repetitive, what we'd call like small t trauma, like not huge, big, singular incident, but repetitive small trauma that can also create a part that has a real distrust over a period of time. And so it's just worth noting that we're not always orienting towards some specific singular instance. Sometimes it's a pattern that existed over the course of a couple years or even 10 years of just, here's how I interpreted people interacting with me, and here's what I received as a pattern as a result, and here's the protective mechanism I built. So why do we want to practice internal family systems? Well, again, this is just building your skill set to talk to yourself effectively, to really understand why you have the patterns and behaviors you have. And doing that prior to a journey is going to allow you to get to deeper and deeper levels of the journey. When you're in a psychedelic experience, this ability to navigate and speak to your parts is turned up way high. And it is really useful to have built in some of the language of how to do that ahead of time. So practicing this just at a basic level, sitting with yourself, taking 20 minutes to go, okay, what parts are present for me right now? What am I feeling right now? And then talk to those things directly. Okay, I'm feeling sad. Interesting. Sadness, what do you want me to know? What are you trying to tell me? Sadness goes, well, it's just, we're really scared right now. We feel really alone. We don't feel like anyone's around us. We don't feel like we have support. Okay, I hear you. What else do you want me to know? And just employ that loving curiosity the same way you would within a journey and the same way you would if you were talking to a 12-year-old in front of you. Like if you imagine there's a literal child in front of you, how would you treat that child if they came to you and go, when I feel sad? You'd be super kind, super patient, at least I hope, and you'd be super curious. Hey, buddy, what's going on? What are you feeling? Are you feeling sad? Yeah, I know, man, it gets like that sometimes. What are you feeling sad about? Maybe I can help. Oh, you're feeling sad because your Pop-Tart broke. Okay, I hear you. Hey, yeah, I mean, I understand that's difficult. And it wouldn't matter to you how unreasonable the thing the 12-year-old was feeling sad about was because they're 12. You would understand that naturally. And you go, okay, I mean, they're upset about something that like obviously doesn't matter. But yeah, it doesn't matter to us as an adult. To them as a 12-year-old, it probably matters a lot. And it's the same thing for your internal landscape. Like sometimes you talk to your protectors and you find out that the thing they're protecting seems totally stupid. You're like, really? That's it? Like, I'm worried that someone's going to be mad at me for drinking coffee in the morning. Wow, that's stupid. Of course no one's going to be mad at me for that. But maybe when you were 13, your dad beat the crap out of you for like stealing some of his coffee in the morning. And it's like, okay, well, it's a 13-year-old part of you that's still scared in there. It has this deep fear of what happens when we get coffee and other people are around. So it doesn't want to do that. And so if it was a 13-year-old you were really talking to, you'd be super understanding, super patient, super loving. But when we talk to ourselves, we often dismiss our own things as irrational or stupid. And so the invitation is to give yourself the space to not judge it, but rather to just try and understand it. Try to love it the best you can. And in doing so, you're really going to broaden your skill set for how to navigate any psychedelic experience. And again, I can't recommend that book enough. No Bad Parts by Richard Schwartz. And that's a great read for someone who wants to get into this technique a little bit further. But you've got the basics here. You've got enough that you can go practice a little bit and start to feel into some things yourself and have some conversations with some parts of yourself that'll enhance your plant medicine journeys. All right, so that's it. We went through tier A, tier B, and tier C. So you are now prepared for a plant medicine journey if you go practice these things. And again, I can't encourage enough that you don't need to be perfect at these things. Like, the reason I split this out into tiers is because, look, the tier A stuff is the stuff you really want to make sure you get as right as you're able to. The tier B stuff, that's great additions. The tier C stuff, hey, if you want to do that, that's cool. That's bonus points. And it'll make your journey maybe a little bit deeper, a little bit easier, or you'll have a little bit more skill navigating it. But if you're not there yet, if you don't have the emotional capacity or the time capacity or the space in your life to practice some of these things, that is okay. I've seen so many journeys at this point that are totally fine, totally beautiful, just focusing on the tier A stuff, the dieta, the intentions, understanding the way the ego works, you know, practicing some microdosing, understanding a little bit about the way the journey works. I've seen plenty of effective journeys just from that. I've seen plenty of effective journeys where they add in just some meditation techniques, some journaling techniques, and some breath work. And then, of course, there are clients who love to just do all of it and do the dream interpretation, internal family systems. And those are tools that you'll carry throughout the rest of your life that are useful even when you're not in a psychedelic journey. So I hope this is helpful for you. I hope you enjoyed it. And thank you for listening. Well, that is it for today. I hope you enjoyed this episode and you got something out of it. And if you are interested in sitting with me in a plant medicine ceremony, you can simply send me an email at alexander@throughtheveil.co and I can send you over some info about sitting in ceremony. Of course, you can find me on Instagram at alexanderdiesel, and you can find my website at www.throughtheveil.co. And as always, if you enjoyed this episode, if you got something out of it, the best thing you can do to help support the podcast, my mission, the things I am working on, is to share it with a friend and to rate it on iTunes and or Spotify. Really, really helps the show get promoted in the rankings and helps more people get exposed to these concepts that I believe are generally quite useful. So much love, everyone. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next time.